Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Bassam Fatou, who is director of the OIS, and Ahmed Mehdi, who is the research associate at OIS, to discuss the key messages that came from both Bassam's paper, Saudi Oil Policy, Continuity and Change in the Era of the Energy Transition, that was published in January 2021, and the Oxford Energy Forum, The Geopolitics of Energy, Out with the Old and In with the New, that was published on the 8th of February 2021 by the Institute. Now, in these changing world, I just want to timestamp this podcast, if I may. We are recording it on the morning of Thursday, the 11th of March 2021. Welcome to you both to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Bassam, if I may start with you. You know, the topics of winners and losers features highly in the Forum magazine, and there are a few articles devoted to the Middle East and North African oil exporters. Could you perhaps provide some background to the debate as to why it's important to look at the MENA oil exporters?
Sure, David. Many are of the view that the Middle East oil exporters will emerge as the definite losers from the energy transition. This is based on the premise that oil demand will decline, and this will erode oil rents, the importance of oil as a strategic commodity, and with it, the geopolitical position of the MENA oil exporters. Also, in a world where oil demand declines, oil exporters will engage in a fierce competition for market share. And this will result in lower margins and revenues. And given the undiversified economic structure of oil exporters and the rigidity of their government spending, this will cause economic disruption and instability, destroying the social fabric of these countries. But this type of analysis is simplistic for a number of reasons. To start with, and as many of the articles in the forum point out, MENA oil exporters are not a homogeneous group, and their resilience and core sources of comparative advantage vary tremendously. We are talking about a very diverse group with very different political and economic structures, different level of development, pursuing different policies, and with different level of sophistication and integration of their energy sectors. This is important because we know from the institutional economics literature that initial conditions influence countries' development trajectories. A related point is that some countries are already well ahead of the game than others and are much prepared to deal with the challenges of the energy transition. More importantly, as Ahmed emphasizes in his article, some key oil exporters are not standing still, and they are evolving and responding to the challenges that the energy transition may bring. David, I'm not very sympathetic to the concept of losers and winners in the MENA context. The energy transition will pose real challenges to all MENA oil and gas exporters. The focus, I think, should be on whether MENA exporters are prepared to deal with these challenges, whether they are increasing their resilience to potential disruptions, and the adaptation strategies they could adopt to make themselves more resilient. And I would argue that some MENA oil exporters are much better prepared than others. And I believe some may position themselves to benefit from the transformations associated with the energy transition and can play an important role in the process.
Yeah, and I'm sure, Bassam, we're going to pick up more on that theme later on in this podcast. But first, I'd like to turn to you, Ahmed, if I may, because in your article, The Middle East and the Geopolitics of the Energy Transition, Myths and Realities, you emphasize the point that the region is not standing still, and the title of your article implies that researchers tend to underestimate the resilience of the MENA exporters. Can you please elaborate on that?
Thank you, David. Yes, absolutely. So as Bassam mentioned, effectively the dominant narrative that lower long-run oil prices impacts the cost of servicing the economies in the region. This is obviously a theme which requires revision. And really the theme of my article was to say that the pathways for MENA exporters, they will vary tremendously, and the trade-offs involved are not necessarily zero sum. So, for example, a shift by Saudi Arabia into hydrogen does not mean that you necessarily have to stop investing in productive oil capacity. Or likewise, there's nothing contradictory in the UAE, for example, planning to increase its upstream oil production investment and its capacity over the next decade and also push forward with very aggressive renewable energy targets. So just as the energy transition is seeing companies and governments place big bets on technologies, MENA exporters, which vary, as Bassam mentioned, in a heterogeneous bunch, they are also doing the same. And so really this brings me to the point of resilience. So we have certain MENA exporters who have already started capturing value opportunities from the transition itself. For example, we've seen integrating solar technologies across the hydrocarbon value chain to improve cost efficiencies and lower greenhouse gas emissions. In Oman, for example, we've seen solar and renewable technologies being deployed for traditional businesses like enhanced oil recovery projects. And also carbon capture is becoming a more prevalent theme across the region as well, not only for improving recovery rates at upstream oil assets, but also reducing more energy intensive methods. So this is all part of the wider theme of how you use actually the costs reductions that come from the energy transition and the improvement in learning curves with new technologies to actually build resilience in existing rent-producing technologies and existing methods. At a more fundamental level, one theme that is something that we've seen as well in the last several years is the growth of gas and renewables in national energy mixes to allow more crude to be exported and to capture more value into other parts of the hydrocarbon value chain, such as refining or petrochemicals. So my point here is that even in, and this is a point emphasized in the article, that even in a carbon-constrained world, the MENA exporters can both remain relevant and in some cases key beneficiaries of the energy transition.
But surely, you know, you must recognize that some oil exporters will fall behind. You know, the reason I say this is I found the comparison between Iraq and Saudi Arabia when it comes to gas flaring particularly interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, it cannot be denied that the starting point for MENA exporters, as Bassam mentioned, differ significantly. And actually, we can take other examples which are not directly related to the energy transition. You know, so for example, Qatar, which was a very early pioneer when it took the decision to make its big bet on gas at a time when other producers treated gas as a useless byproduct from oil production. Likewise, GCC economies who have, you know, large fiscal buffers, sovereign wealth funds, and easy access to capital markets, particularly at a time when investors are searching for yield, they can take advantage of innovative energy financing deals when compared to other countries in the region, such as Iraq or Iran, whether for geopolitical reasons such as sanctions or because of their sovereign credit status. So the starting position, my first point is the starting position will differ naturally. So you're absolutely correct that will actually lead to different pathways. At the same time, however, it's interesting with a country like Iraq because it finds itself almost in a paradoxical position. On the one hand, the country has a great variety of renewable resources, including hydropower, excellent solar potential, and also very good wind speeds, and also a huge amount of unused land. So in this light, distributed solar power, for example, would seem to be an ideal strategy given the high cost of electricity in the country at the moment from diesel generation, for example. And also we have all of these endemic power shortages facing the country. So in a way, the energy transition by actually making the levelized cost of renewable electricity very competitive against, for example, oil-fired power generation or further down the road, gas, actually gives Iraq an opportunity to piggyback on the trends shaping the energy transition. Also, at the same time, when you look at other areas like investment, realistically, who are the key investors in the Iraqi energy space? It's mostly international oil companies, and they recover their upstream costs from the government. So, in a world where these IOCs themselves are laying out net zero roadmaps, tackling issues like gas flaring, for example, can be a win-win for both investor and the government. I mean, just think of a company like BP, who are lead contractors at one of the largest oil fields in the world, which is in Iraq, which is Rumaila. It's very difficult for a company like BP to be rolling out a net zero roadmap, talking about scope 1, 2, or 3 emissions, when they're also actually involved in a field which has high flaring rates, methane emissions, et cetera, et cetera. So my point here is that the energy transition could actually encourage win-win solutions for a country like Iraq. And finally, just to go back to my point on financing costs, project financing models are changing across the entire Middle East. So we shouldn't just see it as a very static situation where, as oil demand eventually comes under pressure and plateaus and declines and margins come under pressure, that suddenly it's just going to be this, the cost of servicing budgets increases. This is all fair, but the point is that we're already seeing innovative new financing models develop in the region. So green financing bonds, extracting value from productive oil and gas assets is a big theme across Saudi Arabia and UAE. And actually old and tired models like those which rely purely on recovering costs from the government may actually change as the pressures of the transition begin to accelerate. So there's a logic which suggests that actually the energy transition spurs and motivates hydrocarbon-dependent economies like Iraq to actually develop and innovate and actually to find new financing models to monetize what is an extremely lucrative reserve base.
I see all of that, but I'd like to pick this up, if I can, with Bassam, because surely diversification must be at the heart of dealing with the challenge of the energy transition, mustn't it, Bassam?
David, I think we discussed this extensively in a previous podcast. It's true that the most obvious strategy for oil exporting countries in face of a disruptive force that could impact a key sector is to diversify their economies away from that sector. However, we need to recognize that despite decades of trying to do so, most oil exporting countries have failed to achieve what I call real diversification, and particularly fiscal diversification. In other words, reducing reliance on oil revenues to finance government spending and the current account deficit. Diversification is only successful if you are able to create new sources of income, for instance, by creating new sectors or new sources of revenues through taxation. Achieving diversification also requires building human capital and improving education systems, as well as extensive reforms to improve the business environment, transparency, and governance. It also needs removing barriers to private sector participation. And fiscal diversification, as I mentioned, requires introducing taxes, both direct and indirect, and reforming prices and subsidies. And I would argue that there is uncertainty about how fast or even whether such extensive economic and institution reforms can be implemented in many oil exporting countries. This does not imply that reforms did not occur. In my paper on Saudi Arabia, I discuss some of these reforms, energy pricing, labor market, and fiscal reforms. And we are already seeing the impacts of these reforms. For instance, the latest data show that gasoline demand and electricity demand in Saudi Arabia, after rising at a very rapid rate, growth rates have fallen sharply or even turned negative. Also, Saudi Arabia has introduced VAT and indirect taxes and other fees on expatriate workers, and the share of oil revenues has been falling. So reforms supported by measures to offset the adverse impacts on households and firms are possible. However, this does not imply that the energy sector will be a less important part of the economy or play a lesser role in the transition in these economies.
Do you see the oil sector continuing to play a key role in Saudi Arabia, then, Bassam?
Yes, and in other oil exporters, as Ahmed just explained, to expect oil exporters to diversify away from the oil sector or the hydrocarbon sector, which constitute their core competitive advantage, and for this strategic sector to play a lesser role in the transition, is not only unrealistic, but is also suboptimal, as oil exporters will be limiting their adaptation strategies by not leveraging on their core strength and their portfolio of assets. After all, David, it's very important to remember that the oil sector remains very profitable and enjoys higher margins than any new sectors that governments aim to establish. Also, governments need to leverage on oil revenues to ease the pain of reforms on households and firms through developing compensation and offsetting mechanisms. The oil sector can also contribute to diversification efforts by creating forward and backward linkages in the economy. And final point, David, is the pace of energy transition is highly uncertain. It is not linear and highly uneven, and there are opportunities that these countries could still capture. Exiting too early from the hydrocarbon business is as costly as exiting too late. And that is why I discuss in my paper in some details the importance of increasing resilience in an uncertain environment, which entails retaining and enhancing the competitiveness of the hydrocarbon sector and increase its resilience against potential risk of disruptions, while be prepared to take advantage of potential dislocations that a transition could induce.
Now, it's interesting because you mentioned dislocations and indeed opportunities that oil exporters such as Saudi Arabia could capture. Could you perhaps share with our listeners some examples?
Sure. One example is the possibility that oil supply could fall much faster than demand due to lack of investment, IOCs shifting their portfolios away from oil very quickly, or even the inability of some oil exporters to increase their productive capacity due to financing constraints or even instability. So those countries such as Saudi Arabia that have the capacity to increase investment at a relatively low cost have choices to make. You know, they could not invest and could benefit from the period of high oil prices and obtain higher revenues, or they could increase their investment and meet the expected increase in demand for their oil. Each choice has its own costs and benefits. Increasing investment and productive capacity can result in higher revenues under certain scenarios. And equally important, can moderate the oil price rise. This is key, as much higher oil price could accelerate the energy transition. On the other hand, increasing productive capacity can result in some of the assets being stranded if demand turns out to be weaker. But given the low cost of production and bringing new investment, this risk is rather low in my view. Therefore, a key element in increasing resilience is to continue to lower production costs, focus on efficiency by taking advantage of advances in technology, which would enable these producers to compete in any price environment and achieve a reasonable return on their investment, especially when compared to returns on other projects outside the oil sector. Just one final point, David, if you allow me. In the case of Saudi Arabia, it has the added challenge that the kingdom maintains spare capacity. Here again, I would argue there are trade-offs. If the energy transition results in many disruptions, then spare capacity could be needed to offset some of these shocks, especially if the kingdom is interested in continuing stabilizing the market through cooperation with other producers. If the strategy shifts to pursuing market share, the spare capacity could become less important, but may still be needed. For instance, it can deter high-cost producers from entering the market. The key point that I try to make is that a country like Saudi Arabia has strategic choices to deal with the challenges of the energy transition, given the size of its reserves, the low cost of developing these reserves, and the high integration and development of its energy sector.
But Bassam, in a carbon-constrained world, don't oil exporters need to compete on dimensions other than cost?
Oil exporting countries will have to compete on dimensions other than cost and compete on reducing emissions. In my paper, I argue that a key aspect of increasing the resilience of the oil sector is to decarbonize production to enhance competitiveness in a world of rising carbon prices. And some oil exporters are well ahead in this regard. Saudi Arabia, for instance, benefits from low carbon intensity of production, has invested heavily in capturing gas and lowering gas flaring and reducing methane intensity. I think they should actually be pushing more actively for verification monitoring and reporting. Also, the potential to improve the efficiency of the domestic energy use and optimizing and diversifying the energy mix by increasing the share of gas and renewables is massive. This would be the most cost-effective way to maximize the oil export potential. There are also opportunities to shift the portfolio towards petrochemicals and non-combustible uses of oil. And COVID-19 will accelerate refinery closures in many parts of the world, allowing some of the oil exporters to capture a greater share in the trade of petroleum products. And therefore, it should really come no surprise that companies such as ADNOC and Saudi Aramco have been developing their trading capabilities to capture these opportunities, and this should be accelerated. And finally, and the most difficult, is reducing emissions from the consumption of final petroleum products to sustain demand for these countries' core products as the transition advances. And here we see some interesting concepts being developed, such as the circular carbon economy approach. But to me, this strategy still faces risks. And the biggest risk is whether frameworks could be established so costs are equitably shared and certain technologies are not discriminated against, such as CCUS. And, you know, just to reemphasize the point that Ahmed made, that while some countries are pushing for one path for reducing emissions, such as electrification and decarbonizing power, we should recognize that different countries will pursue different paths depending on their initial conditions and portfolio of assets and their core strengths. This is why it's very important for oil exporters to be at the table and be very active in the climate change negotiations, pushing for an inclusive framework, which is already happening in any case.
Fascinating. Well, you mentioned gas, Bassam, and Ahmed, I'd like to come back to you, if I may, to talk about gas, because you mentioned in your paper the role of gas as a tool for building resilience in the region and that the region can retain its geopolitical status due to gas. Could you perhaps elaborate on that?
Yes, absolutely, David. As Bassam mentioned, gas will undoubtedly play a greater role in the Middle East energy sector, not only as a way to capture opportunities from, for example, increasing oil exports, but also as part of the wider transition within these countries in terms of improving the efficiency, but also the energy mix as well. So over the past few years, we've already seen key producers such as Saudi Arabia, UAE and Oman announce very aggressive plans to increase gas production. And actually, gas has risen significantly in the GCC energy mix already due to rising production. And even in some cases, we have LNG imports as well, allowing more oil to gas switching in the power sector, for example. But it's also interesting as well that while efforts have been made to develop, for example, cooperation on interconnecting power grids to allay security supply concerns, there's been less effort that been made on, for example, developing integrated gas grids in the region. And so I think actually something has actually gone wrong with the region's general gas strategy. And, you know, I've already mentioned the example of Iraq, you know, a country which flares over around 18 billion cubic meters per year, and also at the same time remains an importer of gas, which is just an absolutely astonishing conclusion when you think about it. So really, there are other examples which, you know, some of these calculated decisions will have to be made. You know, we've seen strategic proposals being presented, for example, to Saudi Arabia around the prospects of importing LNG on a seasonal basis, rather than perhaps opting for developing higher cost unconventional gas reserves. So some of these trade-offs, I think, for example, are going to become more of a focal point. But nevertheless, you know, the point remains that gas will continue to play a very significant role in supporting these diversification efforts. On Qatar, this is really a key example of why I think that the region retains its geopolitical status. It's clear that the big bet that they made on gas will pay major geopolitical dividends as the energy transition increases the role of gas in the global energy mix. So we've already seen, for example, in recent months, the plans by Qatar Petroleum to increase liquefaction capacity from around 77 million tons a year this year to 110 million tons per year. That's a very big deal, David. And I think the North Field expansion will confer on Qatar a number of very significant geostrategic advantages. First of all, they'll be able to capture more LNG market share and gain foothold into new markets as competitors pull back from major projects. Just like Bassam mentioned with regards to where the MENA exporters sit on the global cost curve for liquids, Qatar's role as a low-cost LNG supplier also actually can actually provide a strategic opportunity to actually capture market share, but also increase the hurdles for other new entrants as well, just given both the cost of production and also the volume that the Qataris are talking about. So really, since the lifting of the North Field moratorium, another trend that we've seen Qatar deploy is actually to use not only existing incumbent IOCs to deepen partnerships and expand its international portfolio, but also talk about other issues like swaps, obtaining non-operating partner stakes to actually learn and develop new ways of developing E&P positions abroad. And we've seen a flurry of deals that QP has done, so using its gas leverage to actually gain an international oil portfolio as well. So that kind of relationship is very interesting to watch. And then the final two points I would make on Qatar is, firstly, that the North Field expansion will also confer other new export products as well. So we're going to see additional export revenues derive from condensate and LPG, and also actually increased supply of ethane, which is a perfect feedstock, which will cement Qatar's role in the petrochemical sector. And very finally, in terms of how it's not just like with oil that Bassam mentioned, it's not just going to be the cost, but also going to be effectively the carbon efficiency as well. So Qatar itself has been a bit of a trendsetter in actually signing deals on carbon neutral LNG cargoes. And one of the real corporate entities to watch will be QP Trading, who are not only going to be marketing these spot LNG cargoes, but also actually have been quite innovative in developing unique methodologies on quantifying greenhouse gas emissions as part of these new LNG cargo deals. So absolutely, I think gas is going to increase its strategic importance in the region, and for Qatar, really is a game changer geopolitically as well.
I mean, that's very interesting. I always like to end these podcasts by looking forward. So perhaps I can ask you, what's the role of MENA oil exporters going to be in the clean energy space in the future?
Yes, so there are a number of big bets already being made and being discussed, which will be relevant in a forward-looking manner. So here we're talking about really carbon capture, hydrogen, and in some cases, in fact, we are actually seeing moves into battery technology as well. So really on carbon capture, the region's already been making significant progress. Apart from Saudi's large projects, we've also have plans by ADNOC to roll out plans to capture around about 5 million tons a year of CO2 by 2030. And also UAE has stated its intentions firmly to root itself in developing a hydrogen economy. So why hydrogen? Because it's light and it has exceptional energy density. And actually, as renewables play a greater role in the region, hydrogen will follow through because it will be able to piggyback on that deployment. And also, actually, in some areas, storage becomes important as well because of hydrogen's potential. So actually, traditional oil hubs like Fujairah, for example, could actually begin positioning itself as storage hubs for hydrogen and also export routes for carriers like ammonia. In other fields, I've actually been working with Saudi Arabia's PIF on their interest in expanding into the global battery supply chain, particularly the chemicals required to produce batteries. So I really do expect certain countries such as Saudi, UAE and Oman to be very active in both of these markets going forward.
And it's interesting, one of the things we've been saying this podcast is how diverse these countries are. So they're all going to have a different reaction, different structure as we respond to the challenges of the energy transition. But Sam, I'd like to come to you, if I can, just to finish up looking forward really with a difficult question. Do you think we're likely to see the existing cooperation within the OPEC Plus umbrella continuing? What are your views on that?
Look, reaching agreement and maintaining cohesion within a bigger group of producers is always challenging. But the recent experience showed that producers were able to cooperate together to deal with the COVID-19 shock. Cohesion has been strong, compliance has been high, and producers have been able to reach compromises. What unites OPEC Plus is the belief that through cooperation, countries could smoothen and obtain higher revenues compared to a situation where every producer maximizes production and competes for market share. However, as the energy transition accelerates, divergence will widen due to initial conditions. There's a huge difference in terms of the level of development of the energy sector, the size and the quality of resources, the level of sophistication of oil exporting economies, and better access to technologies. Also, in terms of policies, some countries are pursuing more ambitious, cleaner policies and reducing emissions. Therefore, there will be a group of countries that will be able to achieve better outcome in terms of economic diversification and increase the resilience of their energy sector. And there will be another group whose diversification will go very slow and their energy sector will fall behind in terms of efficiency and reducing emissions. A key question to my mind is whether the current framework can ensure that cooperation continues if the transition accelerates and the divergence becomes too wide. And if the answer is no, can OPEC Plus broaden the scope for cooperation? Is cooperation on reducing emission technologies one way forward, for instance? David, I have no answer to these questions, but I know cooperation in the past always produced better outcomes. But the form of cooperation needs to continue to evolve and extend beyond output policies. My feeling, and I hope that I am wrong, is that each of the producers will walk its a transition path alone.
And I think, actually, Bassam, I think you're going to be right. But I know one thing that we'll be coming back over the next few months and years to ask you for your great insights on this exact subject, which is continually changing. Well, look, thank you to you, Bassam, and to Ahmed, so much for your time. As always, I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on your article, Saudi Oil Policy, Continuity and Change in the Era of Energy Transition, that was published in January, and The Middle East and the Geopolitics of Energy Transition, Myths and Realities, that was published on the 8th of February as part of the Oxford Energy Forum titled The Geopolitics of Energy, Out with the Old and In with the New. And all of those, of course, have been published by the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Now, I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.